better you get.
Have another beer.
No, I want to go home to my own room to sleep in my own bed. I don't want another beer.
Would you like another beer?
Oh, yeah.
I've made my choice, and I choose me.
Lover.
Well, I have a microphone, and you don't.
So you will listen to every damn word I have to say!
You are now listening to the Pop-Up Podcast. It's quite literally a podcast for whatever pops up. Here's the host of the show, director, producer, writer, and however else you know him, Pete Ferrero.
Hi, everybody, and welcome to another edition of the Pop-Up Podcast. This is Pete Ferrero, and it has been an exciting few weeks of interviews and awesome conversation, and I'm thanking you so much for continuing to tune in. Apologies for my voice today. It has been a busy couple of days. I have been filming an independent short film called The Boys Club, but the title may actually change to The Boys Will Be. It's been a lot of fun working with an awesome cast and crew. I'm acting in it. I directed it, though I feel like Dom Savilli, who is an incredible DP, does a little bit of directing in this as well. So constantly working extremely hard on every project that he does. It's been fun. It's been a great couple of days. I'll talk more about that film when I get closer to releasing it and figuring out where it's going to be and all that stuff. But I'm super excited for this week's episode. I am going to be interviewing Mike Walter from Elite Entertainment. I own a wedding video business, and I have for quite some time. I started working with somebody, maybe 2007 or 8, I think it was. I worked for a company, and I'll talk a little bit about that in the podcast with Mike, but eventually went on my own, started a business, and it sort of is what brought to life my love of film and producing and all that kind of stuff, because I got to do so much of that on a weekly basis. And it's funny because that's kind of the stuff that I was always looking to do when I first jumped into wanting to do something and became ambitious. And there was a photographer I saw speak at a conference once. His name is Bob Davis. He's still around. You could find him, though he never acknowledges anything that I write him, because he does, you know, who am I? He had said something one time, your photography or videography can be your passport to see the world. And at the time, traveling sounded like a really good idea. I started working on The Price of Fame, and in addition, started doing a lot of weddings, but I got to do some really cool destination weddings too in the process. So Bob Davis was right. It did become my passport to see a lot of the world. I'm going to talk to Mike Walter basically about, this is going to be a piece for people that are looking to break into the wedding industry. And I'm going to talk to Mike about, you know, what it was like for him opening his business. I'll share some thoughts on what it was like for me. And we'll dig deep into all that stuff and just kind of get you an idea of what it's like. So even if you're getting married or whatnot and you have DJ questions, we're going to do some of that stuff too. I'm trying to keep my open a little bit shorter this week, but I don't have any strong opinions on anything like I did last week with the DMs. I just always want people going for things and doing things, and that's kind of where I was last week. But as every week, we crack open a beer. Now, this is the fourth week that we're cracking open a beer, and I will tell you what I'm drinking, but first, there you go. This is an Anchor Steam from San Francisco. I have been drinking Anchor Steam a long time. I got it in San Francisco at the Swan Oyster Depot, and I just thought it was absolutely an amazing beer. I don't know, I was eating oysters and whatnot, and it just, like, I don't know, it just went perfectly with it. So anyway, I am about to take a quick break, and when we get back, it will be me and Mike Walter discussing the wedding business.
Do you want more updates on the Pop-Up Podcast? Check out our website, popuppodcast.com, for all the latest episodes, upcoming guests, merchandise, and more. Or if you're more of the social type, check us out at the Pop Up Podcast on Facebook, the Pop underscore Up Podcast on Instagram. Now back to the show.
Hey, okay, everybody. So this week on the podcast, I'm super excited because I have Mike Walter with me of Elite Entertainment. Now, we're going to talk about weddings, and we both are in that industry, but we go to Met games, we hang out, and we talk, so I'm sure we're going to move all over the place. But how are you doing, Mike?
I'm doing well, Peter. Thank you very much for having me on.
Yeah, it's exciting to have you. I'm drinking a Anchor Steam beer. They don't promote or plug.
1 o'clock in the afternoon and you're hitting it already. All right, go Peter. I just made myself a cup of coffee.
That works too.
I guess I should put a little something in it then, just so I keep up with you.
New Year. To you, man. Yeah, it's good to talk to you and see you. How is wedding season going for you so far this year?
So it's January, so it's slow. Mm-hmm. We're booking. I mean, we've already had two good weeks of booking 20 and 21 weddings. 2019 was a good year. It wasn't record-breaking by any means, but it was a solid year, kept busy. And 2020 is shaping up to be probably one of our best years ever.
I had a down 19, but it wasn't that down. You know what I mean? Right. Like, just look at a number, like from 40 weddings to 36. So it's, you know, down. Right. But it feels like it's down.
Yeah,
you know
sure.
what I mean?
Yeah.
But now 2020 and 21 have been just incredible, the amount of
inquiries I'm getting. Most of last year, I started realizing and talking about the fact that I just think simply the number 2020 sounded so much more enticing. So you take your typical bride who got engaged last holidays, so the Christmas 2018. That type of bride could either hurry up and plan a 2019 wedding or take her time and plan a 2020. And I think the majority of them, or a bigger percentage than usual, said, "Oh, let's punt and wait a year and a half and plan 2020. And I think some of it just had to do with the number. You know,
I think so too. I mean, even like that happened in 10 to a degree, right? 10, 10, 10.
I've heard it simplified to the fact that and there is some truth to it. You get married in a year that ends in a zero, it is always easy to remember how long you're married.
Sure.
I mean, I'm only married 6 years, but sometimes when people say how long you married, I have to go, it was 2013 minus blah, blah, blah. So, you know what I mean? But in a zero year, you'll always be able to calculate instantly how long you're married.
Right. And I usually answer that question like with last year's answer. And then I'm like, nope, that was a year ago, I said.
right.
Yeah. So how did you, before you get into all of this, the movie picks this year, I found you were on social media. You've seen pretty much everything, yeah?
There's a few movies nominated for the Oscars that I haven't seen yet. But of the ones I've seen so far, Marriage Story is my favorite. I think the acting was so incredible. The writing was amazing. The argument that they get into, I guess, about two-thirds of the way through the movie, it tore my heart out. And I've been through a divorce, didn't have children, so it wasn't as layered and complicated as that. But I can appreciate what divorced couples go through. And that movie just tore at it. I thought it was really amazing. So
I agree with you. Yeah. Now, you saw Uncut Gems and didn't love it.
I didn't love it. I liked it. My problem with Uncut Gems was that it was one speed throughout. It was
agreed.
It was manic energy. Everybody was pissed off and running around. And by the way, I should have asked you, what's your policy on cursing?
It's good. You're all good to go.
Okay, great. So I try not to curse like a sailor, but I just in case I let one slip. But talking about that, leaving that movie, Kelly was like, boy, they fucking cursed a lot. and I mean, nonstop. It is the F word and MF and the N word, pretty
it's
much
everything.
Nonstop. Yeah. And I get that they were going for that lifestyle and they were trying to, you know, show you how that, you know, how that character and how that lifestyle is. I just, you know, like I said, I liked it. I thought it was a scale of 1 to 10. I would have given it a 6 or a 7.
Okay.
Not a 9 or a 10.
Yeah, that's fair. I also found it interesting that everybody's freaking out that Adam Sandler wasn't nominated. But I'm like, okay, it was a personal achievement. Yes, he was very good in the movie. But can you really argue that he was on par with Joaquin Phoenix in Joker or Adam Driver in Marriage Story.
No, neither one. I thought it was good, but I didn't think it was great. I thought his performance, and part of the problem with his performance was even the scene where he breaks down and cries. That's the only time he changes any emotion or energy level or anything else. Mm-hmm. And even that, I didn't buy into.
Yeah, I feel like I'm watching Adam Sandler, and that might be.
Well, but that's the fault of the viewer. Yeah.
Yeah, for sure. Okay, so let's go back. How do you wind up in the wedding business?
So I started out, I dropped out of college and was clueless, 19, 20 years old, about what I wanted to do. Really had no idea, career path, anything else. Actually literally remembered the day laying in my my parents' bedroom, or my bedroom in my parents' house, and I had a brochure for an umpire school and a brochure for broadcasting school. And these were the two things that I had interest in, that I was going to pursue one of them. And reading the brochures and you know, thinking about what am I going to do now with my life. And for some reason, and I think I kind of know why, I chose broadcasting school, because I was, you know, big Howard Stern fan, still am, and thought, and had people had always complimented my voice. So was like, you know, maybe I could do this. Maybe I could do radio, whatever. So I went to Connecticut School of Broadcasting, and from Connecticut School of Broadcasting, I was recruited by a mobile DJ company. And that was really my first experience, not radio, but doing live events. And I was like, oh, this is kind of cool, compared to sitting in a studio in a booth and broadcasting to who knows how many people, and you have no idea what kind of reaction you're getting from the things you're saying and the songs you're playing. At an event, I know whether I've hit the right song right away, dance floor packs, or if the dance floor clears, oh, my bad, I played the wrong song. Mm-hmm. If I say something and it connects with the audience, I know that instantly. And I do like that immediate gratification part of my job.
So, okay, so you get recruited. Now, were you looking at that time, were you looking at other places to, like, do the Howard Stern kind of thing, like radio broadcasting? Or
yeah, I had made a demo tape towards the end of broadcasting school and had sent it out. And one of the things I didn't love about it was I came to understand I was going to need to move and start in a, you know, a small market. So no one steps into radio and gets a job in New York City. So including Howard Stern. I mean, Howard Stern talks about how he went from Hartford, Connecticut to Detroit to DC to New York. And I wasn't, you know, I wasn't a big fan of having to move to just some random town somewhere and get my broadcasting, you know, career started. So that had a lot to do with it, that this opportunity was going to keep me in the tri-state area.
So is there somebody that becomes like a mentor that takes you under their wing?
Well, yeah, the two guys that I started working with a company called Star DJs. I don't know if you've been in the business long enough where you've overlapped. So they were huge in the late 80s, early 90s. I started with them in 88, and I was their 12th MC on, you know, that they were booking. Mm-hmm. And I know people shake their head and go, no way. 5 years later, when I left them, they had 50 guys. Wow. And the problem is it crumbled under its own weight. But for a while, they were just this huge company that crushed everything in New Jersey wedding-wise. And so the two guys who owned that, John Murphy and Rick Galdi, became my mentors. And they had a training program for us, which is something that I copied and emulated as soon as I left them. The whole concept of, oh, you can train DJs to do this. There's a lot of people in my industry who just think you have to find somebody who's been a veteran who's been doing this for a while. I've always taken the mentality and taken it from those guys at Star that if I find somebody with no experience but with the right personality, I can teach them everything they know about this that they're going to need to know about.
That's very interesting, though, because I've taken some acting classes, and I took an acting class with Richard Klein from Three's Company, who played Larry on that show. And he also feels that this thing about the it factor, right? Do some people just have this natural ability to act or be a wedding DJ? And can you train somebody that does not necessarily, when you first meet them, have that it factor? Richard Klein believes that he can train anybody to be a good
actor. So my answer to that question would be no, maybe just because I've never taken the time to do that.
Right.
I consider myself a real good DJ trainer, but I stack my deck because I only invite people into training who have already demonstrated that it factor. They've demonstrated that they can do the public speaking. They've got an outgoing personality. They're fun. They're, you know, I mean, they're you know, people sometimes in their resting state are boring. Some people in their resting state are fun. I'm looking for somebody who their bottom line is they're fun, outgoing people. So I can train somebody like that and turn them into a fantastic MC. To be honest, Peter, I've never tried it. I don't know if I could take a flat line, somebody with no personality whatsoever, but maybe if they had the desire, I don't know.
It's tough, right? It's like teaching someone how to play guitar. If you don't know how to tune it up and whatnot, you're going to have a tough time doing it.
Yeah.
But are there certain DJs that maybe are better at, say, mixing a set list as opposed to being a publicly, like an MC? Is that a thing? No doubt.
I mean, you know, that skill is, that's a talent in and of itself. And there are plenty of guys who are great DJs who just don't, you know, work well on the microphone. I'm currently training a guy right now, and I think I'm gonna flesh it out of him. But he is a great mixer, and right now he's fumbling through the emceeing part. I think, you know, he has an amazing voice, and he is a fairly outgoing person. So I think I'm gonna be able to create a great MC with him. But who knows? That, you know, that's to be seen. But he is a phenomenal DJ.
So just in the middle of this interview, the Mets announced that Carlos Beltran is stepping down as manager.
Did you seriously just got that?
I just saw the breaking news alert while we're doing this. Yeah.
So do you think they told him step down?
I think so. I think that's probably the only way it would have worked.
Well, most people would rather quit than be fired. So, I mean, if you pull somebody like that into the office and say, look, we're going to have to let you go, unless, of course, you wanted to step down, then I think most people are going to say, yeah, you know what, I'll just step down. I wonder what that does for his contract, though. Does that mean he's not going to get paid? Because if they had fired him, that's a guaranteed contract. So then,
right, and that would have been two managers the Mets had on.
Oh, is that right? And,
well, now they would have a third manager that they're paying for this year, right? Because Mickey Callaway is still a manager here, but he was fired, right?
Okay.
Coming into this season. Now Carlos Beltran would have a managerial contract. That's the second.
Well, we still pay Bonilla $1 million a year. Why don't we have him manage the team?
He's not doing anything.
Yeah,
maybe bring back Terry Collins at this point. I think he's a manager still staffed as well. Yeah.
So what are we, 3 weeks away from spring training, and now we don't have a manager?
And we're also in the same boat as the Astros and the Red Sox, so that's now a thing, right?
True, yeah. Yeah.
Which
means we have two franchises with better talent pools who are now scrambling looking for a last minute manager. So of the three last minute managers that are going to get hired, we'll get the least experience.
Oh, definitely. Yeah. Right. Because Dusty Baker and a couple of those guys are still around. You know, we're not going to be in on that.
Right.
Right. We'll be in on, you know, somebody that's within the organization.
Does Bachman have a job yet? Wally Bachman?
No. Bachman. Oh, maybe this will be the break. Yeah,
you know what? I've long yearned for him. I loved his energy when he was a Met and scrappy guy like that. So maybe things will work out. You know?
Yeah, but so that's funny that we just started talking before we came on here talking about the Mets thing, and now that's official. I guess it's better to get it out of the way than for this to go on till spring training. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I think so, right. To get the team focused on getting ready for the season, it was better to just get this out of the way.
So what is the wedding world like? What year is this that this is happening to you, by the way?
This is 88.
Okay, so this is still way before so many things that are currently available. There's no social media.
Oh my
right?
God, no. Yeah,
there's not even cell phones to check in on a DJ and see how he's doing.
Correct.
There's no texting.
Yeah.
And in terms of the format of how you're playing music, is it records or
all
is it
vinyl?
Cassette?
Well, vinyl and cassette. I mean, yeah, CDs were not a thing. I mean, they were a thing yet, but they hadn't penetrated the market. So when I started in 88, I went out with two turntables and a cassette player.
That's very interesting. And so what is that like? What is that like for you?
Well, gear-wise, it's so much easier. I mean,
today,
it's easier. Yeah, it's easier to transport the gear. And it's also easier to teach somebody the basics because, you know, back in the day, the basics of queuing up a song on vinyl, there was a number of steps. You had to put the needle on the record, listen for in your headphone, listen for the first sound, hit stop, back the record up a quarter of a turn so that when you hit play, you didn't hear that. You didn't hear the song ramping up to speed. You didn't hear that and then it getting up to speed.
Right.
So there were a lot more steps than nowadays, you know, click this button and it loads it into the right side. It's way simpler than it used to be.
And are things skipping? I mean, I know that's
Oh, yeah, no doubt. Yeah, I mean, there were there were dance floors where I used to have these four foam kind of spongy things that I could put underneath the four corners of my coffin, and that's what we called it back in the day,
right?
So that it would almost kind of levitate. And I didn't need it all the time, but there were certain dance floors that, yeah, if people stepped too hard, it would make my record skip. Yeah.
And how... So how is the transition then from record to cassette to CD and today? You know, was it just like an inevitable sort of like, okay, it's not, I don't have to worry about queuing up the record anymore. But queuing up a tape, I would imagine to be even harder.
Oh, even harder. Yeah, cassettes were never the prompt. Cassettes were always like your backup or, you know, if there was a really hard to find song. I mean, this is file sharing before file sharing was a thing. Like, sometimes if there was a really hard to find song, but a buddy of yours had it, well, he didn't want to lend you his record because he might need it that night, so he would tape it for you. But yeah, I mean, if you've ever seen, sometimes they share a meme on Facebook or on social media where there's a cassette and a pencil, and someone will say, if you don't know what these two things have to do with each other, then you, and what they have to do with each other was the same concept. If you were queuing up a cassette, you would listen for the first sound, then you'd hit stop, you'd eject the cassette, you'd stick a pencil in the teeth and rewind the cassette just a hair so it was now before the beginning of that song. Same concept as backing up. God, I'm having flashbacks here of how horrible the technology used to be. But yeah, it was the same. That was the same type of concept. But and, then okay. Going to CDs, where it was just a for a while, I had two turntables and two CD players, so I was playing on. And then it finally got to the point where I was just like, I got to pull the Band-Aid off and make the transition.
And you just transitioned from no vinyl to just CD.
To just CD. Yeah.
But there's still some guys that are doing vinyl stuff today.
So you know, it's funny. Vinyl has become so retro. It's really, really funny to see it. Yeah, there are some DJs that will that advertise and promote themselves as I'm all vinyl. And there are certain things you can do on vinyl that you can't do digitally. But not a lot. I mean, I will never go back to bringing vinyl out.
Just, I can't imagine why. And I'm sure even though couples are probably like, yeah.
No one knows. People claim that they know the difference, the listener. But the only way you really would know the difference is if you hear the imperfections in the vinyl.
Sure.
You know, every once in a while you'd get that pop or that.
Totally.
That's something in a vinyl. But I don't believe you can hear, you know, people say, oh, I can hear the warmth of the vinyl. I don't know. I'm sure people will call me out on this, but I don't think you could. If you did a blind taste test or a blind hearing test, I really don't think most people would know the difference.
So in terms of emceeing, you're obviously getting more confident or getting better at what you do. When do you sort of realize, like, because I mean, you went to school to broadcast, right? And I'm sure that dream might still have been floating. You're trying this out, but is there a moment sort of in your career where you feel like, okay, yeah, I'm good at this. I'm good at, you know, working the wedding rooms or the party rooms. And is there a specific moment in time where that happens for you?
I can think of a few. One of them that really stands out. We did a lot of bridal shows back in the day at Star DJs. And we had these two main MCs, Paul Geiger and Danny Vinez, who were just, they were the gods at Star DJs. They both had this, and again, this is late 80s. They both had this Bon Jovi-esque, long, flowing blonde hair. They got the most referrals. They were the best DJs on staff. And so they always had the high-profile positions at our bridal shows. And there was a bridal show we were doing. Maybe I was 1990 now. I've been doing it for 2 years, what have you. And we show up at a bridal show. We're getting ready. And one of them couldn't make it. So there was now this prominent emceeing slot at the show that we needed somebody for. And the owner of the company, John Murphy, said, Mike, you can do it. And I was like, you want me to do it? And he goes, I've heard you practice it. I've heard you rehearse it. He goes, I know you're ready. And I got up there and I did really well with it. So that was a big moment for me where I was like, shit, these are shoes that are filled by the gods here at Star DJs. And I was able to do it. So yeah, that was an early moment where I was like, oh, maybe I've got something here other than just being an average MC, you know?
And what is the world of weddings like back then? Obviously, I feel like partying is always a thing and drinking and stuff is always a thing. But were the parties in the 80s and early 90s a little bit more extreme than they are today? Or is it always just what it is?
Yeah, I don't know if extreme is the right word. But, because what you just said to start this is so true. Fun has always been fun. Partying has always been partying. Dancing, like that will never leave. The biggest change for me in my industry is that the interaction has been tamped down a little bit. Part of our at Star DJs, you had a gear list that you had to put together before you did your first party. Part of that gear list, believe it or not, was a sequined jacket. Right. They used to make us buy a sequined jacket, and you only busted it out maybe once or twice a night. But at certain moments of the party, I would take my jacket off and put the sequined jacket on, and I would jump up on a speaker and lead a dance, or, you know, that level of interaction nowadays is inappropriate. It just wouldn't. Most people would look at me and go, what the hell are you doing? I don't want you at my event. So, you know, I've had to change my style of emceeing through the years because of what's appropriate and what clients are looking for. But that's really the biggest change that I've seen.
Okay, well, I did a wedding maybe about, I don't know, a couple years ago in New York City, and they hired a old school sort of a DJ that probably came out from the same period of time. Right. And he was drinking before the set, but at a pace that was, you know, not just, hey, one beer or one drink before we get going. Like, he had two or three drinks, he's waiting for the party to start, and you know, obviously it's somebody who has been working in the industry a long time doing that. Was that a thing back in the day where DJs would drink too much and then, oh my god, you know, it's like a party, like it's like a rock star's lifestyle, only, you know, on a smaller scale, obviously, in terms of being a
I don't think Star DJs had a no drinking policy. So I think it was one of those things. It was like, yeah, you're working, if you want to have a drink or two, you can. Obviously, they didn't want anybody to you know, get inebriated.
Sure.
But when I started the company that I own now, one of the first things I did was implement a no drinking policy. I never saw it as professional. You're working, you're supposed to be on your game. So we have a no drinking policy, but I don't even know how people would do it nowadays, because unless you snuck in your own booze, because almost every banquet hall I work at frowns on the work. You know, they won't serve you as a videographer, they won't serve me as a DJ, they just wouldn't even serve us. So I don't even know how people would get alcohol, how somebody working would get alcohol, unless, like I said, they snuck in a flask, in which case, if you're doing that, if you're going to that ends, sounds to me like you got a problem.
Yeah, obviously had a problem. Right. But I
it's
guess
like drinking beer at 1 o'clock in the afternoon, Peter. Like, then, you know, that's when you know you got a problem.
So was it like, I think a lot of people in their industries from that time period, I guess is where I'm going with it, is they kind of refer to it as the Wild West of the industry at that point. Was it the same for weddings, do you think? Like, in terms of, we could get away with a lot more. We could say things that probably we wouldn't say today.
You know, I think so. I think a lot of it had to do with the fact that when I first started, again, late 80s, the DJ was the exception to the rule. You know, I used to show up at events and everyone, you know, banquet managers that would say, oh, you're the band. And so bands were still the main prominent thing. So I think that probably lends itself to what you're talking about, that we were such an aberration that we were kind of writing our own rules at the time. And copying bands, I think most bands probably have a drink or two and they consider themselves the entertainment rather than whatever, so they can get away with that. So yeah, maybe, but I think very quickly our industry realized if we're going to be taken seriously, we need to act more professionally.
And, you know, as I was getting into the business, I would hear stories from older DJs that had said things like, and I don't know if this ever really happened. I think we and I have talked about this during the Met Game once, but that, I don't know, you know, using records that people would come in and the FBI would come in and say, you can't use records, these records, you know, because due to copyright and things of that. Does that happen? Have you ever heard stories?
I have heard stories of that, but I believe it's all urban legend. I really don't think, first of all, it's not an FBI thing. It's an ASCAP thing. So
right.
The FBI has bigger fish to fry than walking into somebody's wedding and confiscating the DJ's records. But
right.
I don't think that that's ever happened. I think that that's urban legend. Basically, the way it works out in our industry is ASCAP still has not decided what mobile DJs should do, so we don't have to pay anything right now. Mm-hmm. And as an industry, we've approached the music industry and said, tell us what we want to be compliant. Tell us what you want us to do. If I have to pay 5 cents a song that I'm playing at an event, that's fine, because that levels the playing field. If I have to pay that and my competitors have to pay that, we will build that into our cost of doing business. But currently, unlike radio stations, we've kind of flown under the radar.
It's similar in the wedding video business too. You know, obviously, we're all using the songs, right? Every pop song that you can imagine, because brides want to hear, you know, Billy Joel.
So you're talking about when you make your final edit,
yeah, like the highlight video, right?
Right.
And then some wedding videographer had a video go viral in the last maybe 10 years that Oprah shared using the Will I Am song. And wow, they came down on him hard. And then that changed everything, where wedding videographers are looking through. There's a website called The Music Bed, and it's sort of independent artists. And you can.
Yeah, there's a number of different websites where you can get royalty free music. But I mean, if you're talking about, like, for people listening who don't know, Peter shot my wedding 6
Correct.
Years ago.
Yeah.
You did a phenomenal job editing the final pieces and giving it to us. You used commercial music on that.
I did.
But we didn't. But as long as that's not broadcast somewhere, who gets hurt?
Right.
With
so
that?
in the feature videos that you watch, that's good. That's all good.
Right.
It might not be. You know what I mean? Like, it might still be illegal to sell a product with unlicensed music. But
so should I have said that theoretically you used commercial music?
Right. And I knew
you can
it was
go back
in
theory. Edit that out.
It was definitely in theory.
Right.
But
right.
but when it comes to, like, sharing online, it's become an issue now, right? Because now everybody wants to share their videos on social media.
Right.
And now that industry has gotten cracked down a little bit about, you know,
it's the same thing in our industry. It's different for me playing a song live to a crowd, or, and this is something I try to do because I'm promoting myself, recording a segment of my night and putting it up on the internet. Now I'm using copyrighted songs, and that can get taken down.
So anyway, but you've never seen the FBI.
I don't even know anybody personally who had that happen to them. It's always been a, you know, hey, I heard this happen to someone. I think it's urban legend.
Have you ever had an experience? I saw this once, a wedding DJ, where someone knocked the plug out. And everything.
Oh, yeah. I had the Mater D
once.
What
is your worst of these kind of, like, stoppages?
I had a Mater D do that once, literally during the first dance. And understand, from a DJ's point of view, playing the bride and groom's first dance is, that's the most nerve-wracking part of the night. This is the song that this couple has chosen, the most important song. I mean, you remember how long you married. You remember your wedding song, right?
Absolutely.
And that moment when you're dancing to it, and they, for some reason, pulled a plug next to my plug, and they accidentally pulled mine. And I'm like, of all moments that this had to happen. Now, we plugged it back in, and I think I was on CD at the time, so there was no way. And this is where records would have been an advantage, because with a record, you would have started it back up at the same spot. But with the CD, I basically had to start the song over again.
Right.
So it took a minute, basically, to bring my system back up.
I was going to say, I'm sure the system needs a minute.
And at that point, I don't even have a microphone. So I'm like, sorry, folks, somebody pulled my plug. You know what I mean? And then they plugged me back in, and I had to bring my system back up. And as soon as I got my microphone, I said, listen, we're just going to have to start that song again. And I think I made a joke. There was a videographer. I said, we can edit this part out, right? And I gave a new intro to their song, and we went through it. Yeah, I mean, that happens. It's only happened to me that one time, when it was during the first dance. But not only sometimes pull a plug, but you also lose power from time to time. You know, sometimes you're in an old building, and I've pushed a sound system too hard, and maybe we have lights and stuff like that. And the next thing you know, you trip a breaker, and it takes you a while to get back up and running. So these things happen.
Yeah. So inevitably you leave Star DJs, and I think people that are listening will find this fascinating of their that are trying to get into the industry. How do you determine to it's time for me to go out on my own? Now for me in wedding videos, I was working for a company for a long time as well, and because wedding video started to change a little bit and it wasn't sort of that old school wedding video anymore, I had come up with a different style of wedding video with a bunch of us all at the same time sort of started to do that. And, you know, people started to come to that studio now, no longer just for the photography, but they were looking into the video because they had started to see some of the samples. And that sort of fueled my desire to say that, okay, I could definitely continue, you know, working on this percentage system, but I think now might be the time for me to go do my thing. And of course, then I launched my own thing. And that was a difficult transition for me, because to tell people that you've been working with, you know, that this is going to happen, it turned out to be pretty dramatic in my case.
Right.
What about for you? How did that happen for you in terms of...
Besides DJing for Star DJs, I also worked in their office. So they hired me. I started out doing sales, and then they moved me over to operations, which is what I preferred. So I kind of, because of that, I had some inner knowledge of the company. And I saw that they were, internally, they had made some mistakes. They were way over their head in debt. And I knew things were not going to end well. So I jumped ship while the getting was good, if you will. Mm-hmm. I didn't want to. I called myself at the time a reluctant entrepreneur. I really never envisioned, if things had stayed good at Star, I was making more money than I ever thought I'd make at 27 years old, because they were paying me a salary in the office plus doing events. So I was doing really well for myself. So financially, I wasn't looking to jump ship. And I never thought about being a business owner. Now, fast forward 28 years later, I don't think I could ever go back to working for somebody else again.
Yeah. It's funny, because as I know you, I could never see you
right.
working.
But I didn't grow up with this, you know, neither of my parents owned their own business. So it's not like I had this gene in me that I had to be an entrepreneur. So it was really just, I saw things at Star going down, and it turned out I was right, because they don't exist anymore in this market. They actually had opened a satellite in Detroit, which I think still exists. But if you, and I'm sure you know, and you might not even know that you know them, there are so many DJs in New Jersey who can connect their ties to Star DJs, either first rate like me or second rate. In other words, people who have, like, I've trained people, so I consider them like the grandchildren of Star DJs. If I'm a child, the people that I've trained through the years are one generation removed from Star. I would bet close to 50% of the DJs in New Jersey can somehow trace their DNA back to Star DJs. That's how influential.
So that closing must have been pretty shocking at the time. Were that?
You mean me leaving there?
And also Star DJs not being a thing anymore.
Yeah, I think it fizzled rather than imploded. They continued to lose a lot of talent. I was one of the first to jump ship, and then others left. And again, I think what happens, and this is one of the reasons why I'm so credit or debt adverse, because I saw what happened to them. Once you get yourself head over heels in debt, you start making some really bad decisions, and that's what I saw at Star. So I've just avoided that my entire career. I don't even like to borrow money to buy new gear. Like, I wait until I have it in the bank, cut a check, and be done with it. So, it was really more of a slow, from 93 to probably, I don't know, 98, Star just kind of slowly dissipated.
And so it's about 98 when you decided to open your business?
No, I left them in 93.
Okay, so you left in 93. Now, did you kind of base your model off of what you were doing at Star, or did you come
very much so? Yeah. In a smaller scale, obviously, initially. I had a partner first up. He actually had started Elite, and then I joined with him. And then I bought him out a couple years later, because he was all over the map as far as, I want to DJ, I want to be an actor, I want to DJ, I want to be a pilot, I want to DJ. So I finally was like, I can't take this anymore. I bought him out. Very much so, as far as like training talent. To me, that was the biggest thing. There are DJ companies that don't even bother training talent. They only hire existing DJs. And usually that means they're poaching. They're going to other talent, you know, other rosters and trying to entice them to leave a company and come on board. And then there are companies like myself who I don't believe in poaching, and I would much rather take somebody like I just talked about, this guy, Barry, and train him to be an MC. And I think what happens with training is that you earn a little bit of loyalty along the way. If I have taught DJs how to do this, and basically what comes with that, a little quid pro quo, is that they're going to stick around with me because I've given them an opportunity to you know, make some money as a part-time career.
So back in that day when you're starting, did you always know you were going to be multi-op, sort of many DJs and whatnot, or was there part
again
of
that goes back to that Star DJ model? They, you know, mm-hmm. John and Rick at Star always believed in duplicating this business model, and you know, the minute I joined up with Eric at Elite Entertainment, we had the same philosophy. This isn't just about filling our calendar; it's about finding some other DJs and booking them and training them and booking them as well.
So what was that process for you, like finding DJs? So you're now on your own, you know, you're going at this without you know, a regular consistent paycheck, right? You're just going to hoping that you're gonna, and there's no,
it probably took
no
me,
like the knot, you know what I mean? There's no,
it took me 3 years to get back to the level financially that I was at Star. So I took a especially that first year. I mean, mm-hmm. if I didn't have savings, I would have lost my house. You know, I basically left a pretty solid paycheck and walked into next to nothing. But so back in the day, finding talent was classified ads in the newspaper. And nowadays it's Craigslist and Facebook ads. But, you know, bottom line is when we start getting busy, which means 3 or 4 months from now, I will recruit for assistants, because most of our weddings go out with a 2-person package. The second person is the newer person on the job. So we hire for that. It's an entry level position, and we bring in new people that way. And from that pool of talent, going back to the it factor, the people who demonstrate some of that it factor, those are the ones that are invited into MC training.
Is there a particular point in time where you realize, okay, I've done this now, I have a better version, no offense, better is probably the wrong word, but I have done what Star DJ has done and I've improved upon their systems? Was there a moment where you realized that?
Yeah, I'd say the first couple times I trained people. I mean, I wasn't sure. I had helped with the training at Star, but I had never been the main guy when it came to training. So when I left Star, and one of my first duties at Elite was find some talent and train some talent, and did that, and then that talent became successful, that's when you can go, okay, I'm good at this. I'm, you know, I know how to train people. And now it's been almost 30 years, and I can confidently say, you give me somebody with the raw ability and 3 months, and I'll have an MC that people can't believe is brand new.
Interesting. So then obviously times start changing. Digital music is now a thing, right? You can download music and all this stuff. How is the industry changing as you're in it?
Well, I'm sure it's very similar to your industry. The entry level has gone down. The bar for entry into our industries is way down, which means, you know, somebody with a couple $1,000 can become a DJ overnight, or at least claim to be a DJ, buy the right gear, download a bunch of music, watch some videos on YouTube to learn how to do this stuff, and voila, you're a DJ. Now, you don't have the experience, you don't have the life experience or the party experience, anything else, but you can hang up a shingle and say, I'm a DJ. Sure. Same thing in your business.
I mean,
you know, you can buy, I mean, I remember back in the day when video cameras were this big thing, you know what I mean? Now, a couple grand gets you a decent, not,
oh,
you know,
definitely.
Quality, 15, but
you get a,
decent.
You can get a camera for $1,500.
Right, yep. Exactly. And put up a website or even just a Facebook page nowadays and say you're a DJ, say you're a videographer. Say you're a photographer, say you're a DJ.
Yeah.
So the bar of entry has definitely been lowered, but so be it. That just means you have to, for people like you and I who are trying to get a higher dollar, we just have to sell our experience and sell the overall, you know, the overall product and quality that we're going to offer.
And in terms of like the music digital files, that had to be a game changer in your world, being able to download music.
I have more music on my phone than I used to carry in crates and crates of backbreaking records. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So, yeah, I mean, there's no such thing anymore for a DJ to say, I don't have that song. Because even if you don't have it, you could download it during the gig. You know,
exactly, right. Well, that must have been convenient sometimes when you didn't want to play Uncle Ted's.
And that's the point of the point of that is that no longer is it I don't have that song, but now it's should I play that song? Just because you can doesn't mean you should. There are songs that I have on my hard drive. Sometimes someone will ask for a request and I'll filter. I'll go, I don't recognize that. I'll filter it and it's on my hard drive. But again, that doesn't mean I'm going to play it because my goal isn't to make one person in the room happy and sit 150 other people. My goal is to please as many people in the room as possible. Now, if it's the bride or groom, of course, you're totally going to play for. But if it's, you know, cousin Joe over at table 12, he wants to hear some obscure song that I'm pretty sure is going to clear the dance floor. Now, I can't use that as an excuse. And that was a joke to you. But I can't say, sorry, I don't have it. But you just have to put somebody like that off.
Do you say, I'm not playing that song? Or do you say, let me see if there's a
I start vaguely. Let me see if I can get to it. Let me see what I can do. If it becomes a persistent request, then I have said to people, you know what? I listened to it. I don't think it's going to work, so I'm not going to play for it.
Yeah, I mean, I can't even imagine the mindset of one of these relatives. Listen, I love the Stones, right? So if I came up to you and said, what do you think about Miss You? You might try to sneak it in because it's a dancier song, depending on the audience and the couple and all that. But I can't imagine coming to you and say, you know, some obscure song off of Tattoo You, you know, in the middle of the record. Right. I can't even imagine what a mindset is
like. And that's where it depends when you ask me that, because if it's a obscure song, but it's sort of mellow and you ask me that before dinner, then I can play it during dinner. I can dump it in. You know, there's that half hour time spot where I'm not dancing people at a reception. And so I can play some. Now, I'm not going to play something too heavy during dinner.
Sure.
But if it's mellow or mid-tempo, I don't care how obscure it is. If I can make somebody happy by dropping a song in during dinner, I'll do it. I remember a number of years ago, I was doing a wedding, and some guy came up to me with an hour left in the night, maybe not even 40 minutes left in the night. Dance floor is jam-packed. Energy is hot through the roof. And he's looking at my gear, and he goes, I used to be a DJ. And I was like, oh, really? He goes, can you play some Sam Cooke? And I said, well, listen, if you used to be a DJ, then you would know Sam Cooke is not appropriate right now. You should ask me that 2 hours ago. You know what I mean? I will play Sam Cooke 2 hours ago, but 40 minutes left in the night when I got the dance floor here, no, there's nothing by Sam Cooke that's going to work. So, you know, a lot of it is when you ask me, you know, for a request.
Right. And I'm sure some of it's also, I mean, is there a personal preference in this too? Like, are you like, I've tried that once, you know, I'm not...
Yeah, I try to leave my personal I mean, as big a Stones fan as you are, I'm a big Prince fan. I don't play Prince during my events. Every once in a while, if I have a big 80s crowd, I might play 1999 or Kiss. But I don't go out of my way to play Prince music during my events. I just don't do it. I don't force it on my crowd. But as far as personal experience, oh, no doubt. I mean, if a song burns me once, I am much less likely to play that song again. And if it burns me a second time, then, you know, that song is probably going to be on the shelf unless the bride and groom ask for it.
So at the risk of the guy with $2,000 that's starting his DJ business right now, listening to this.
Okay.
What is your method in determining a great, and I know you do a lot of seminars about this and whatnot, so you don't have to go into the whole thing because we want them to buy your book. We want them to... get your videos and your classes and all that stuff. What is just kind of generally the right way to come at this if you're just getting into this in terms of creating the right vibe and feel for a dance mix set?
In other words, if somebody is green, the inexperienced, you know, then my recommendation would be don't start at weddings. Do other events, find a bar that needs a DJ on a, you know, Thursday night for $100. Get some experience before you book a wedding, because it's way too important of a day for somebody for you to be, you know, gaining your experience at a wedding. And B, be, you know, if you screw up the bar night on Thursday night, it doesn't, it's not affecting anyone's life. But if you go out there and screw up somebody's wedding, that's, you know, that's a pretty monumental thing to do. So my advice would be learn your craft in a spot other than somebody else's wedding.
Is there a science to creating a set list? I guess is what I'm asking.
There are opening songs, there are songs that are good middle songs, and there are good peak finish songs. When I plan out a dance set in my mind, that's what I'm thinking of. I'm thinking of what song is going to get as many people to the dance floor as possible. That's an opener song. And then I try to build the energy through there. Now, energy doesn't always mean BPMs, but it often does. Which means if I'm starting at like a 115 BPM, I'm slowly climbing up, slowly climbing. And then maybe I'm climaxing in the 130s and then either breaking off that set, which means slow it down, go into dinner, or snap it off and change tempo dramatically, maybe jump back into a hip hop song or something like that.
How challenging is, and not specific venues, but how challenging are venues where the maitre d' now, you finally got this energy in the room or whatever, and you're doing your scientific way of building to a room, and now he says, we have to do dinner 10 minutes early, or some unusual thing is now happening in you know, based on
stuff
time.
Happens, man. Stuff, I mean, you have to be flexible as a DJ. You have to be, when you're programming the night, you have a vision for how you want to set and even the whole night to go, but you have to be fluid in that. And, you know, I referenced, if a bride and groom asked me for something, I do it in a second. You know, I can have this whole dance set planned out in my head. If the bride comes up and says, hey, my uncle's about to leave, can you play that Wonderful Tonight for me right away? Boom, I'm slowing things down. I'm changing directions. So it's not just the maitre d' moving dinner up or the photographer taking the bride and groom out for the sunset shot. Things like that happen all the time. I'm not the type of vendor who gets upset by that. You roll with the punches.
Is there a bit of improv then in what you're doing as
no
well?
No doubt. There has to be. There has to be. I mean, even in the fact of, let's say none of those factors weigh in. If I drop a song on a crowd, I usually think I know what the next two or three songs are going to be. But if I drop a song on a crowd and it clears the dance floor, well, I got to make a hard left-hand turn because what I thought this crowd was going to dance to, they're not. So I've made this point in seminars that half of programming is observation. You have to constantly be looking at the room. Where's their energy? Where is this dance floor going? Can I give them more or do I need to pull back? And you only know that by observing. That's why I don't understand how some DJs are on social media during their events. Like, I just don't have the brain capacity to do both things. I'm programming, I'm picking out my music, and I'm watching the crowd. I don't have a third eyeball for getting on Facebook. During dinner, I might make a post on Facebook. At the end of the night, I might make a post. But during the event, I don't know how people are doing anything but DJing.
And I see it a lot. I see people, you know, you know what I mean? And it's like,
sometimes I see my own DJs do it, and right. I'll text them and go, dude, I don't know how you're posting right now. You should be rocking the dance floor.
To the songs that you say a song burns you, do you have any good a song burns you stories where you were like, this is gonna be perfect, and then it's not?
Well, you know, I'll tell you one where it burned me, but then I eventually changed my mind on it because everyone else did. I want to see if I can get this date right. I'm pretty sure it was 4 years ago, and it was right around this time of year. A couple months later, it was spring. I had a DJ friend of mine sent me a YouTube link, and he's like, dude, I just heard this song. I think you're going to love it. It's cool. And I listened to it, and I was like, yeah, this song is going to be big. So I had a wedding coming up that weekend. I got myself a copy of the song, beat mixed it in perfectly, and it cleared the dance floor. And I was like, God damn, it was Blurred Lines.
Wow.
And the problem is I played it, and this goes back to something I talk about in my seminars. Most people want to dance to a song that they recognize. I played it too early. People didn't know it yet. A month later, when the song was everywhere, that was packing my dance floor. Blurred Lines was like one of the banger songs for the next year plus. But and I felt like calling the I felt like asking the bride, can I get the phone number for every one of your guests and call them and say, see, I dropped that song on you and you ran away. I was turning you on to a great song. So, yeah, I mean, that's an example. I got burned by it, but I didn't let that change my mind. But I'll give you one. And because I'm on the Jersey Shore, we get more Bruce Springsteen requests than, you know, I'd network with DJs in other markets. If you're in Chicago, you never get a Bruce Springsteen request. It just doesn't happen. But here in New Jersey, but people ask for Born to Run all the time. It is not his best dancing song. Dancing in the Dark or Glory Days are and Rosalita, if you've got a really good Bruce crowd. Those are the three best dancing Bruce songs. But people will ask me for Born to Run all the time. Now, again, if it's a bride and groom, I'll play it for him. But if it's just some guy in the back of the room asking for Born to Run, what I'll say is, look, I'll play some Bruce, but not that one, because that song has cleared too many of my dance floors.
I believe that too. Yeah, because and like Dancing in the Dark is so great, right? It's such a great tune that people can. It's Bruce, or even maybe what is it, Jersey Girl?
Ironically enough, Jersey Girl is not. He did not write that song.
Right, but the version.
Do you know who did? Come on, Peter.
I don't know.
That's a Tom Waits song. Tom Waits wrote that song.
I knew that. Yeah. I should have known
and,
that.
And Bruce covered it in concert and put it out on that live five records thing that he put out in the 80s. And that's how Jersey Girl became kind of his signature song, but it's not his. For a guy who's famous for writing his own music, that's not a Bruce Springsteen.
So is that one that you get a lot too in terms of Bruce?
Yeah, definitely. As a slow song, no doubt. Yeah.
I guess slow songs work differently in terms of requests. I'm just asking. I don't know. Yeah,
they do. I mean, well, first of all, I don't like to get too many of them, because if it's a great party, I don't play a lot of slow songs. I just don't. You know what I mean? Yeah. If it's a banging party, I've gone literally the whole second half of a party without ever slowing it down if they're a good enough dancing crowd. So I don't want to get, you know, if a bride and groom give me 15 slow songs, which happens from time to time, I'll ask them, hey, can I play some of these during dinner? Because I don't think I'll get to every one of these. So, And yeah, I mean, if a guest comes up and asks for a slow song and I was about to slow it down anyway, that's perfect. I'll play that. Or sometimes a guest will come up and ask for just an artist.
Right.
And if I was about to slow it down anyway, then maybe I'll just play a slow song by that artist and kind of check it off.
Right.
You know.
What's okay, a few more. What is the weirdest song request that you've ever had?
Do you know the song Closer by Nine Inch Nails?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. I wanna fuck you like an animal. I had a bride and groom ask me for that as their wedding song once.
Right.
Wow. And I said, I don't think there's an edited version. And they said, we don't want an edited version. So that was their wedding song.
Oh, that's
that's pretty extreme. One of the strange. And I introduced that by saying, ladies and gentlemen, the bride and groom have specifically requested not only this song but this version. And if you know our bride and groom, you know that this is appropriate. Boom.
I think that's the only way that you could.
Yeah, because I didn't want everyone looking at me going, I can't believe the DJ is playing this. Exactly. This is not. I will often make an announcement to that regard. If brides or grooms ask me for something that's so obscure and so weird, I just want everybody in the room to know I am following the lead here. This isn't my, because I'm looking at lost future business in that case, and people assume that I'm that Closer by Nine Inch Nails was my call. You know?
And I'm sure, I hope people know that you would probably try to talk them off a ledge on something like that. You know what I mean?
I think this was many, many years ago. This was when that song was brand new. So I don't remember.
Yeah.
You know, I've gotten more confident through the years trying to convince a client that maybe their ideas aren't the best and everything else. But at the end of the day, if I try to talk you out of it and you stand firm, listen, it's your wedding. I will do pretty much whatever you want me to do.
And also a part of your world now is doing ceremonies and officiating. How did that come up? And the first time where you're like, me? Like, how did that?
I got ordained. Kelly, my wife Kelly, had friends years ago who basically asked me if I would do their ceremony. And I was like, sure, I'd never thought about it, but I was like, okay, I can give that a shot. And I got ordained online, which is $30. It's the biggest bullshit ever.
Right.
especially if you know my religious views, the fact that I'm technically a reverend, there's something funny about that.
It's hilarious, actually.
So I did that as a gift for them, and I found that I really enjoyed it. One of the things I've never loved about playing the music at ceremonies is that there are so many officiants in New Jersey who they crank out weddings nonstop, sometimes 3-4 a day wedding ceremonies.
True.
And they do zero to personalize the wedding. Literally, the only thing they do is change the first names of the bride and groom, and that's it. I can sit in the back of ceremonies if certain officiants are doing and literally lip sync along because I've heard this guy say the same exact thing at 50 weddings. So I said, look, if I'm going to officiate, I don't want to do that. I want to personalize. I want to work with my couples. And so basically I interview brides and grooms before their wedding separately. I send them emails, you know, ask them questions about, tell me about your first date. When did you realize you fell in love? Who said I love you first? Describe that moment, describe the engagement. And then I personalize the beginning of their ceremony. So I get to tell their love story, if you will, a little bit. If I can find something funny in that moment, that usually works. It's great to get people laughing. Very similar, Peter, if you remember, Kelly, and my ceremony. We had a friend of ours from California do it. And Randy is a funny guy and a witty guy. And he had a couple of really funny lines and personalized our ceremony to exactly what we were, what we wanted. So that's kind of my goal when I officiate.
And you got married to, you did someone's wedding. You married the person, right?
Yes, there. I know when people hear that they think, yeah, we can go there. I'm not hiding it. Yeah, I mean, when people hear that they think there's scandal involved and everything else, but there's not.
It's sort of scandal. Yeah, you know what I mean? Well, but not in the moment. But you
right,
know.
But it's not like we were making out during her cake cutting, sure, or something at her first wedding.
Right.
I DJ'd her wedding. Didn't see, and I think I DJ'd her wedding with my first wife. Saw her again at her cousin's wedding 2 or 3 years later, said hello, she's still married, I'm still married, everything else. And then a few years after that, I had gotten divorced and her mom called, and P.S., I always thought Kelly was beautiful. When I first met her, I thought she was beautiful. Her mom calls the office to book a holiday party and I take the phone call and, Kelly's mom, great. I said, how are Kelly and Chris doing? And Elaine said, not too good. They're separated. They're getting a divorce. And in my memory, I'm sure I've exaggerated this through the years, but in my memory, I went, really?
Can I get her number?
And, yeah, exactly. So we went out, we had a safe first date and then hooked up. And it was actually, we started dating basically during her divorce, which was a bad time. And so we dated for a couple months and then broke up. And then 2 years later, we got back together when it was really like a good time for both of us.
Was planning your wedding difficult because of all the obligations, people that you've worked with? Now, this is in the midst of the industry where you have lots of friends, lots of people that want to work it, or, you know, was that challenging, or even just determining like what we're going to do? How is my wedding going to be different than everything else?
Think that was the main challenge. Was we wanted to make sure I had probably 40 or 50 wedding industry veterans at the wedding, not just DJs, but there were a couple photographer friends of mine, a couple banquet people friends of mine. So I didn't want these people showing up and going to a wedding that they did every single weekend, 100 times a year or what have you. So we did a couple of twists in our wedding. If you remember, first of all, we kind of juggled the timeline a little bit. We had a cocktail hour and then we got married.
Yeah.
Matter of fact, 45 minutes into cocktail hour, our ceremony just simply began. Kelly did not process down the aisle. We didn't have any big thing. We literally just, there was a riser in the middle of the cocktail hour room. Randy, who was our officiant, Kelly and I both stepped up on the riser and we just started. And people realized what was happening immediately and gathered around. We didn't have chairs in the room. So, and I know you have great video footage. Basically, awesome. Everybody stood around in a circle and watched us get married. So that was one of those you know, I wanted to mess with everybody who's so used to doing weddings and knows the timeline inside and out. I just wanted to kind of tweak their day for them a little bit.
I kind of felt better, actually, having the ceremony in that particular place in the order of events. You know,
I think so. Yeah. I've had a few people who were guests at my wedding say, man, that was so cool the way you did that. Yeah. You just kind of got married during cocktail hour. Yeah. I'm really happy with the way it worked out.
The invention of one of the last questions, with the invention of social media, has it been, I'm sure there's pluses and negatives to social media in this era, but has it been challenging where I feel like for me too, in video, there was a period of time where I was just trusted to do what I did, you know, to trust it to kind of, you know, make a video and it's going to be awesome and you don't have to worry about it. But I think with so many people seeing various clips and getting various things that they see so quickly now, do you find it challenging that there's more input in the process of what you do?
I don't know if I'm understanding your question exactly, but here's how I'll answer it. The biggest challenge that I find with social media is that it is a ever hungry beast. It always constantly needs to be fed. You know, back in the day, you'd create a marketing piece, whether it was a brochure or a demo video, something like that. You would work on it, you'd complete it, and then it would be done. And then you would send it out to whoever, you know, every time somebody called, oh, let me stick my brochure in the mail, let me send you my demo video. But the challenge with social media is that you can never rest on any kind of laurel. Whatever post you put up yesterday, you need to put up another one today. You need to, you know what I mean? You need to constantly feed that beast. And it's tiring. To me, it can get exhausting, you know, where you just, I'm always searching for content for social media. So that to me is the biggest challenge. Now, one of the premises that you presented to me before we went on the air was you want people who are brand new in this industry to learn from this podcast. That's the one thing I can say I'm envious of the 20-something-year-old who's getting into this industry. And when I say, I don't mean just DJing, but video or photo or anything in the wedding, is that they are digital natives. They've grown up with this. To them, it's part of their language. They, you know, I've had to learn a lot about what I do on social media, and I'm still learning. I'm still constantly, you know, tweaking and trying. But for somebody who's a millennial, or even what are we calling the generation younger than millennials, they're so used to social media, it comes natural to them. So that's one regard, besides the fact that I wish I was 30 years younger. That's one of the reasons why I envy the 20-something-year-old getting into this industry, because for them, the social media platforms are going to be second nature to them.
So lastly, what is the biggest, going to the people that are just getting into the industry, what is the biggest piece of advice maybe that you were told or that you would give somebody that's thinking about getting into the business outside of do a bar first? What would you tell them to, if they're getting
thinking about it? I would say to them that, I know it sounds cliche, be yourself, there's only one you, that type of thing. But along that line, don't try to be everybody's DJ. Figure out who you are, figure out what your skill set is, figure out what your specialty is, and then focus on that, and you'll find your clients who want that. You know, I'm a fairly outgoing MC, and I know that turns some people off. That's not the style. You know Jason Janai very well. Jason and I are completely different entertainers. He's got his fan base. I've got my fan base. I don't try to be him. He doesn't try to be me. And I think that's one of the reasons why we're both successful in this. So that's what I would advise anybody. Same thing, somebody getting into your industry.
Yeah.
You know, there are different ways to shoot weddings and different ways to edit. Do what you do, and the client base will find you, rather than trying to be something for everybody. You know, doctors, the specialist always makes more money than the general practitioner. And I think it's the same thing in our industry. If you're a specialist at something, you're going to find less clients, but you'll be able to demand more from those clients that you're finding.
All right. So, Mike, tell everybody where they can find you or book you for weddings and whatnot.
And so the name of my company is Elite Entertainment, and we own that URL. So you can find out all about us on at eliteentertainment.com. And if you are in the DJ industry and you're interested, I have a couple of videos that I put out, some training videos, and a book that I've written about growing your business. That stuff you can find at djmikewalter.com.
And he's very entertaining to follow on social media, especially particularly.
Well, you should put air quotes around entertaining. Apparently, I'm maddening to some people, but yeah, I do like to stir it up a little bit.
Oh, you certainly
do.
Yeah. But now I love being, it's a wonderful spectator sport to watch what Mike Walter has stirred up on Facebook this morning.
Yeah, yeah. It can often get interesting. And when you say this morning, that is usually my routine. I have my breakfast in the morning. I read my newspapers. If something intrigues me or whatever, I put up a post on Facebook. And then often I get super busy all day long, maybe look at it at lunchtime, maybe not till after lunch. And sometimes I go, I've got 300 comments on that thread. Like, I don't even have time to read all that. So, yeah, you're welcome to friend me on Facebook, but you're also welcome to unfriend me as quickly as possible if you find that to be annoying.
And I know you're flaming me with the Mets comments that you make sometimes.
You know, you've been a Mets fan less.
Me and PJ.
I'm older than you,
yes,
and so I'm a little bit more jaded.
Sure.
So I come at the
kidding.
Whole Met thing. And believe me, I wish I had your optimism and your faith.
Yeah.
It's been beaten the hell out of me, Peter. I wish to God that somebody in 1986, when I celebrated that World Series, I wish somebody had sat me down and said, Mike, this is the last one you're ever going to get, because I would have celebrated a little bit harder. I think I did. I think I squeezed every ounce of celebration out of that. But I also thought that was the beginning of we were a dynasty about to happen. I was like, this is the first of how many? And meanwhile, it's 34 years later, and we don't have another one.
I know.
And that's tough. And meanwhile, the Yankees are upset because it's been 10 years since they've had one.
And the Astros cheated. Wah,
right,
wah.
Right, right. So, yeah, the whole Met thing
for the
is...
Last, you cheated through the whole 90s.
Yeah.
The
yeah,
Yankees in a different way.
Yeah. Right.
Anyway, it's great having you on, man. I'd love to do more of these with you if that's cool.
I enjoy it. I can't believe it's been an hour already.
I would look down and I was like, okay, well, no one's going to listen to 3.5 hours of us talking.
Yeah, so let's hit pause on this now and have me back on anytime.
All right, awesome, man. Thanks so much for being here.
Appreciate it. Thank you.
Have a good one. Yep.
Thanks.
One of the ways you guys may know me is from my pro wrestling documentary on the Million Dollar Man, Ted DiBiase. Called The Price of Fame. And I wanted everybody to know about a really awesome convention that's coming to New Jersey on April 18th at I Play America. It's going to feature wrestlers like The Honky Tonk Man and Zeus, and Lex Luger and Hacksaw Jim Duggan, The Rock and Roll Express. I saw Ted Arcidi, who is on that list. That's pretty cool. The Haiti Kid and Sean Mooney and so many more. To find out more about this event, go to 80swrestlingcon.com. Again, that's the 80swrestlingcon.com website for more information about their convention on April 18th at iPlay America in New Jersey. So that was Mike Walter of Elite Entertainment, and he's really become a great friend to me in the years. And actually, I would go as far as say a mentor to me. I know we're in totally different industries, but every year, despite his disparaging comments about the Mets, we try to take in one or two Met games, depending on the season. And the car rides in are always filled with lots of information and just not even just about the wedding business or business in general, but just, just life experiences and things that he's been going through. And I definitely take a lot from him. So, and I learn a lot from him is what I mean by that. Just an absolute great guy. I loved his wedding. And I always find it to be completely fascinating to know what's going on in someone's world and how they do what they do. So I hope to do even more of those as the Pop-Up Podcast continues. I did say, at the top of this or during the interview that I had worked for a studio for some time, and that it was a dramatic exit and experience. And I am, I think I'm ready to talk about some of that because I do feel like there's a lot of lessons to learn in working in toxic environments and environments of that nature. And so I didn't talk about it on the podcast with Mike today, but I think in the next, over the next couple of months of the Pop-Up Podcast, I will definitely dive in to some more personal stuff. So I'm not there yet, but speaking of personal stuff, I am planning an episode of The Making of The Price of Fame, which is the documentary film I did on the Million Dollar Man, Ted DiBiase. So that's being planned in the works. And then next week, given what's going on with this Carlos Beltran New York Mets scandal, I've decided to reach out to Mets sports writer Rich Mancuso, who I grew up listening to on WFAN late at night. And so next week, Rich Mancuso and I, we will dive deep into all the things that are going on. So next week will be sort of a current topic, the New York Mets. Now, I record these episodes about a week in advance, so if some shit happens, I don't know what to tell you. We're behind. But I'll catch up for you. Anyway, thanks so much for listening to the Pop-Up Podcast, and I will see you next time.
Today's episode of the Pop-Up Podcast was brought to you by Sunspot Films. Thanks for listening. For updates, check out popuppodcast.com.